session number 24925, reel 4.
You were only at Bournemouth 2 weeks.
Sorry, so you were only in Bournemouth for 2 weeks?
Mm-hmm. Are you ready to go?
Yep.
In Bournemouth 2 weeks, then I was posted, I heard to, not on the brigands, but to learn to fly bow fighters. Now, before I could do that, I was posted to a place called Shawbury, which is an advanced flying unit, and I flew airspeed Oxfords. And there was a satellite drove aerodrome at Shawbury called Condover.
Presumably, one of the main planes that people wanted to fly was Spitfire.
Well, I didn't ask to fly a Spitfire. Of course, the majority of us were posted to bombers. I think there might have been a few to fighters, but I don't know who they were.
People talk of the disappointment that they felt once they'd been posted to a bomber.
Well, I think that I wasn't... I think I'd have been a bit disappointed in being posted. I was quite happy to fly a bow fighter. I'd never heard of a bow fighter really much until I'd been posted onto one. But I knew the stories we had heard about night fighters appealed to me. I'd heard stories of people going over to Germany and shooting up aeroplanes at the well, they took off and landed, which rather appealed to me. I thought that would be interesting. Anyhow, I did a thing called a BAT course, a beam approach training course, at Stratus Hall. We went from one place in England to another by train, and we I don't know how long it took us. I forget now, but. And, of course, everywhere we went, we were very keen to drink a bit of English beer, which we thought was a bit flat and warm compared to the stuff we'd been drinking. But we soon got used to it.
What was your impression of England?
I liked England. I thought England was a... I thought they're having a very tough time. And they were... It was interesting to see the way they were coping with the situation, and I admired them. I thought they were doing a good job. I thought they were very brave. And this beam of post.
How were they seeing you, though, the Australian?
Well, I never worried about how they saw me much. I thought that was nothing to do with me. I've always taken the view of I like to look at other people and. And how they treated me, they all seemed to be all right, and no one treated me any differently to anyone else. And there were a lot of pretty girls, and they made life interesting. And I thought I rather enjoyed it, and I liked the English people.
Being in the mother country, the old country.
No, that never occurred to me much. That never occurred. I didn't get that feeling I was in the mother country at all. I just felt that I was in England, which is a country at war. I didn't have any feelings like that at all. But on this beam of approach training course on Oxford, they taught us to fly in dreadful conditions. You'd take off without seeing the end of the runway, which you'd never do in Australia, and you'd fly around with just what this beam, with A's on one side, north of the field, and N's the other side. One was Dida and the other was Dardit. And when the two merged together, it was one continual note. So you knew when you were on. Then we learned how to fly there. But the flying conditions in England were appalling compared to the Australian. You know, they'd cancel flying in Australia, and in England, and the weather conditions, you'd just take off as though nothing had happened, which shook us all a bit.
Well, people talk of the casualties being high, and the weather was part of that.
Well, I think so. I think I think a lot of the casualties are caused by, I'm afraid to say, pilot error, weather, and not most of them, but some of them, a good proportion. I don't know the percentage of, but there was a lot of pilot error, and they're all, these fellows were young, and I remember a fellow called Alf Bransby. We were doing low flying in a bow fighter from Catfoss, and he said to his fellow in the same room, he said, "I'm going to get over that North Sea and fly as low as I can." Of course, he never came back. He flew too low and hit the water. That was it. And of course, rather tricky flying with a very calm situation. You can't get the distance as well as you. So he never came back. But now, and when a fellow like that, and there's another man, Frank Terry, he was killed in Edinburgh at night. I can remember him saying, at flying at night, he said, "All my instruments have gone wrong." And of course, we realised that the instruments hadn't gone wrong, he had gone wrong. So he went in, and that was, we had to bury him. But when these things occurred, when Alf Bransby and Terry and various other people died, we were concerned, but not alarmed. I don't think I was, I've never been alarmed about anything.
Well, obviously like there is that sort of side of the bonding that was to happen in relation to chaps going off
yes.
together.
And if you'd meet, we'd all go to, everyone all over England would go to leave in London, and you'd say, "What's happened to so-and-so, and what's happened to so-and-so," and find out who had done what and when. And there's always great, and it still has, it's been like that ever since we joined up.
Did that ever stop you, the fact that you might lose your mates or something like that?
No.
Did it ever stop you from getting too close to Ireland?
Well, it did, I think. Yes, I can remember, you're quite right. I can remember on the squadron I eventually was posted to, I was never very close to anyone, including my navigator. It was an RAF squadron, and there were Canadians, South Africans, New Zealanders, Australians, mainly English. And I was never very close. Sort of feeling that you didn't want to get too close to anyone. But it's interesting enough that after just recently, in the last 10 years, I've contacted these people that were on the squadron. We've become great friends. I've had them staying out here, and I've gone to stay with them in Canada and England, and we correspond, and we have that a particular bond. But I think on the squadron, I wouldn't say it was a lonely life, it was a different life, but I made no close friends.
Can you give us an idea of the average day training now in England?
Well, you'd get up, about, we're always amazed, it was pretty dark then, we were training in over the Christmas period, and it would get dark. It was dark up until about, 7 in the morning, probably 8. You'd have breakfast. The food was always good. I'd never complained about the food. We would do lectures on various subjects, engines, navigation, theory of flight. Then we have to do lectures on air gunnery and bombing. And it's all very interesting. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And after the after we'd finished, we were posted up to Scotland to get on the bowfighters, bowfighter Mark 1. Was it the 1? No, it was the bowfighter Mark 2, the Rolls Royce inline engines, our night fighters. And we did our training up there. I remember one fellow taking off at East Fortune. His first takeoff, and it was very, they were inclined to swing these bowfighters, and he was amazing in that on his takeoff he swung 180 degrees, careered off and finished. It was the most unusual takeoff, but he didn't bend anything, thank goodness, and he lived to tell the tale. I can't remember. I remember we used to do, at Catfoss, we did a decompression test where you'd get into a chamber which all the air would be pumped out, it would simulate going up in height. And I can remember there'd be about 8 of us in it or more, and one fellow had to take his oxygen mask off. And we'd watch him as he got up, how the lack of oxygen affected him. And of course, he gradually got sillier and dopier and casual. And we realized what could happen if you didn't wear your oxygen mask, which is the whole point of the story. Then they asked someone at 17,000 feet to take their oxygen mask off. And I remember I volunteered, and they said, take it off. And I felt all right. And you're inclined to get very overconfident with lack of oxygen, at least I did. And they asked me to do simple sums, which I felt perfectly capable of doing. I remember one thing, they got me to multiply 3 figures by 3 figures. And I found that I was doing it, and I was doing it correctly, but I was running off the side of the page all the time. I couldn't understand it. But everyone realized that oxygen was vital. So that was the thing of the whole exercise. And of course, a lack of oxygen makes you very tired. You'd sleep well after that. And then I remember there was a place called Catfoss. We went to do our advanced operational training there. And we'd fly, and as I say, in any sort of weather. And then at night flying, I remember there was an air raid on one night. We took off, and we were told to hold, I can remember, I was told to maintain a height. It was known as Seven Angels. They said, go maintain height at Seven Angels, which meant you had to get to 7,000 feet and circle. This is north of the drone. And we had to do cross country. Or having done the cross country, where I was doing violent evasion from stars that I thought had been other aircraft. You know, I do a 90-degree bank turn away from a star until I settled down and realized what it was all about. And then I remember landing at... I was flying a Mark 1 bowfighter, and Rob Cameron was... he was holding somewhere or other, and the place, the CAFOS, had been bombed. It had been bombed quite heavily, and one runway was out of action. And anyhow, I was told to land, and I forgot to put the undercarriage down after all the excitement. In a bowfire, you have the hydraulics, which you select on, then you select the flaps, having the hydraulics being operating, and then you put the undercarriage down. Well, I selected the flap lever instead of the hydraulic lever, thinking that was the... Anyhow, I forgot to put the undercarriage down, and I came in, and I'd been up for about 4 hours, late at night, and I was tired, and I thought, what's that dreadful noise going as I was coming into land? Of course, it was the horn warning me that the undercarriage was up. And I came in and landed on the runway, quite a good landing, but no wheels. And they had to get the RAF regiment, who there must have been hundreds of them, who bodily picked up the Bowfighter, which was 26,000 pounds, and lifted it off the side of the runway. And I was most upset about this, as you can imagine. And the flight commander called me in and said, "Now, tell me about it. What did you do?" And I thought, oh, well, I'd better tell him the truth. And I told him the whole thing. Expected to get a great old rocket. And he said, well, it was a Mark I Bowfighter, very early Bowfighter, and I never liked it anyhow, so don't worry. And that was the end of that, so I was very, very pleased.
In relation to pilot error, people talk of the gremlin.
Yeah.
The experience of pilot error, you mentioned a couple of stories to do with that.
Yeah.
How you would try and prevent pilot error?
Well, I suppose, really, there was a thing called P.O. Prune. It was a magazine that came out in a thing called TM. TM was short for training manual.
Sorry, you were talking about, obviously...
Yes, this TM training manual and P.O. Prune, that was read with amusement. People thinking, oh, it'll never happen to me.
Who was P.O.
Prune? P.O. Prune was a pilot officer who did all the wrong things. He did, if it could be done, he'd do it. And sort of ridiculing, the idea was to ridicule the... if a person landed with his undercarriage up, that's what the sort of thing that P.O. Prune would do. No one wanted to do this. And P.O. Prune had all sorts of funny sayings. It's quite an interesting, humorous manual to read, and people used to read these avidly and get a bit of a laugh out of it and say, oh, of course, P.O. Prune did this and that. But subconsciously, they were saying, well, I hope I don't ever do that. And I think a lot was learnt from P.O. Prune. And I think that it was you're being taught very subtly what to do and what not to do, which was...
Well, obviously there was this understanding, and then your officer talking to you, I get the impression there was this understanding that these are the sorts of things that could happen.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily anyone's fault.
Well, it was obviously my fault there, but they were very good about it, or this fellow was very good about it. And there was no standover tactics in the training. They were helpful, and they were full of guidance, and I enjoyed it. And I thought that the method of training in the RAF was... excellent.
Obviously, been talking about Christmas of 42, 43. now in 43, I presume. How eager were you to get out there, to get into the war and stop this training?
Well, we knew I was going to finish. I must tell you one little story. We had to finish this. The course was going to finish. A new course was coming in. They had to get rid of it. And we hadn't finished our night flying. The weather had really been bad. And, of course, you can't fly in fog. And we were waiting. We had to finish so many hours night flying, and about 10 of us were waiting in this thing called a Nissen hut, a round hut. And it was a cold night, and we had a coal fire, a little stove in the middle of the hut, with a chimney going up to the top. And I then heard one instructor must have had a great sense of humour. He quietly climbed up to the top of the Nissen hut and took the green part of a very cartridge, undid it, and dropped the green flare down the chimney, and it hit the fire and green smoke everywhere. Terrific green. And with that, just as it happened, someone locked the door and called out, "Gas!" And it was rather amusing to see that the reactions of everyone. Some people were beating on the door, and some people were trying to hold their nose, and some people were... But it was...
quite humorous hearing what was going on inside.
Well, yes, they, you know, anything for a laugh for these instructors. But anyhow, when they left us a complete wreck and ruin, they opened the door and said, "Right, you can get on flying now, get on." But it was quite a memorable occasion. And from Catfoss, all the course were posted to a place called Skye, the Isle of Skye, to do a low flying course. And my navigator and I weren't. We were posted straight to a place called Filton Junction to pick up a bowfighter. Not because I didn't need instruction on low flying. I think I was only posted there because my name began with A. And top of the list, they wanted a crew, off I went. We went by train down to Filton Junction and picked up a brand new spanking bow fighter. But the weather, as I say again, was appalling. I didn't realise they were wanting me to pick up a bow fighter and fly it that day, and I had to fly it to a place about 30 miles to the east of Filton. And they said, "Well, off you go." And I said, "I didn't have any maps." And the fellow said, "Look, you don't need maps, you just need to follow the railway line." So I took off in this atrocious weather, and I must have been down to about 50 feet. And following the train line, got into a tunnel. And you can imagine, I was a bit nervous about the whole thing. So we eventually arrived at this place, spent the night, and did it the next day, a fuel consumption test, about 6 hours flying around England, and then off to... The next day, to take it to a place called the bottom of England, Lynham, which is on the tip of the southwest of England. And we had arrived there late in the afternoon, my navigator said, "Just head due west, you'll hit the coast and follow the coastline down to Lynham." But I nearly hit a lot of barrage balloons, and I turned left. I hit the coast and followed it on the right, but of course, the wrong coast, and I finished up near Bournemouth. But, so I was a bit late in getting there. We had a very late night, and the next morning left for Gibraltar. So to Cape Finisterre, and there had been a crash on takeoff prior to us taking off, and we had to hold for a long while before we could take off. They had to clear the runway of this crash, and they warned us that we'd be very, very short of fuel. We'd be have to conserve our fuel. And after all this waiting, I was a bit nervous about fuel, especially the fuel consumption test I'd done the day before. They found that the tanks were leaking, and they said, oh, don't worry about that. Anyhow, off we went, and when we got to a beam of Portugal, I did a calculation, and I said to my navigator, I don't think we've got enough fuel. And Dick said, I don't think we have either. So we were supposed to go right down to the bottom of Spain, then head east and go into Gibraltar. So I decided to low fly, at least to go over Portugal, go direct from where I was, make a direct line to Gibraltar. And we were told that we must not fly over Portugal. It's a neutral country. I thought, well, I'm not going to crash. And so I went down, and the clouds got lower and the hills got higher, and I had a marvellous time low-flying over Portugal all the way to Gibraltar, and landed there. We're supposed to go 5 miles south of Gibraltar at 3,000 feet and fire off the colours of the day and then come in and land. Well, the weather was down to about 50 feet, so I thought, it's ridiculous going to do this. No one will see the colours of the day. So I went straight in and landed, and I'm very fortunate to get in. There were three other people on that flight who landed at Gibraltar and crashed that day. So I was fortunate. We had a night at Gibraltar, went into the town, and as you say, it's all very exciting and new, and went over to North Africa to a place called Blida, near Algiers, the Atlas Mountains. Had about a week there. And I can remember from we're all being paid with English paybook. I never saw an Australian payable for a long while. And I landed at Blida and I had no money. And so I went to see some fella, and some RAF bloke, and he said, what do you usually get? So I thought of a number. He said, oh, that'll do. And he gave me this wad of money. I never heard about it again, so I think I owe the British government a bit of money.